If I had a title for today, you probably can see it on the yellow sheet of paper, it would be this. It's How to Prosper. And my main text for that is verses 9 and 10 of chapter 3. Honor the Lord with your wealth, with the first fruits of all your crops. Then your barns will be filled to overflowing and your vats will brim over with new wine. We're in sort of gift day mode back at All Saints, so we're looking at Proverbs for a couple of Sunday evenings, which is why you've got the Proverbs treatment as well. But I'm struck by how unashamed about the pursuit of wealth the Bible is. And that actually is something that I suppose the world outside the church can easily understand, because they think that the pursuit of wealth is what life is all about. They probably turn not to the Bible but to the newspapers, to something like the Guardian article I came upon over the summer. The winner of the UK's biggest lottery jackpot was revealed today as a mother of one, this is August the 17th this year, who works in a Royal Mail sorting office, or at least did at that point. I'm not sure what's going on now. Camelot launched a nationwide public appeal for the mystery winner to get in touch following the Friday draw. She was today revealed to be Angela Kelly, who's in her 40s, lives with her 14-year-old son John in a modest flat. Ms. Kelly, who paid £1.50 for a lucky dip ticket, did not know she had scooped the £35.4 million fortune until Monday. The ticket was in her handbag. She only checked it when she realised the jackpot had gone unclaimed. Ms. Kelly has reportedly told colleagues she will not be coming back to work. So the vigorous and enthusiastic pursuit of wealth is something we'd get from the papers. We're surprised to find it in the Bible, in verses like the one I read at the start. It's not surprising with stories like that that the lottery's become a national obsession. A few years ago, if you'd asked a young child what they wanted to be when they grew up, they might have said a pop star or a sportsman. Now, they're just as likely to say a lottery winner. It's everybody's dream, isn't it? Interesting to me that when William Wilberforce heard his triumph in the movement to abolish slavery announced in Parliament, he's supposed to have turned to the colleague that was sitting next to them and asked, what should we abolish next? And you know what they agreed? The lottery. Well, striking, isn't it, that the Bible doesn't answer the greed which drives the lottery by suggesting we pronounce money evil and that we have nothing to do with it. It's lovely to have that supposed proverb up on the screen, that money is the root of all evil. That is, I guess, the most misquoted verse in the Bible, and it's not a verse in the Bible. That's actually what the popular 80s song told us, but it's not what the Bible says. Paul told Timothy that the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil, which is actually a slightly different thing, a very different thing, because the writers of the Bible didn't have their heads in the clouds. They actually had their feet on the ground. They don't despise riches or idealize poverty. So as you turn to Proverbs, and we'll have a bit of a taste of it this morning, there's actually a wealth of practical advice on how to prosper. It tells you how to gain money to start with. And I think the most frequent answer to that is by hard work. On the sheets, you've got Proverbs 20, verse 4. A sluggard doesn't plough in season, so at harvest time he looks but finds nothing. Not hard to understand that verse. It's pretty clear. You don't plough, you don't eat. And I was reflecting, I'm very grateful that my parents drummed those sorts of values into me as a teenager. I had a very privileged education, a lovely home life, but every holiday as I grew up in my teen years, I was sent out to work, often in the sort of grunt work that Proverbs talks quite a lot about, agricultural labor. So I would be carting straw bales or plucking turkeys or picking hops. And brilliant, my parents wanted me to learn the value of hard work, of meeting the standards of a boss, of paying for my own social life at an early stage, of achieving some sort of independence. And Proverbs agrees with that sort of approach. It tells you how to gain money. It also tells you how not to lose money. A couple of Proverbs for a hint of this. Proverbs 21, verse 17. He who loves pleasure will become poor. Whoever loves wine and oil will never be rich. Now, that's not supposed to be a universal rule. I guess that we can all think of people in this area, locally to here, who are the exception to this as a general rule. Actually, probably worth saying that Proverbs aren't meant to be taken as statements of facts precisely. If I say to you, a watch pot never boils, and you decide to sort of run a little experiment on that, you go away and come back tomorrow, you say to me, look, Simon, I'm very sorry, but I was intrigued by what you said to me, so I tested it, I turned the kettle on, I decided I wouldn't go away and do something else while it was boiling, I'd watch it the whole time, and it did boil in a few minutes. And I know what you're thinking, Simon, you might challenge me. I know what you're thinking. I never took my eyes off it for a second. I stared at it the whole time, and a watch pot does boil. You've missed the point, if that's your process of reasoning, because Proverbs are supposed to be figurative, not factual. When Proverbs tells us, he who loves pleasure will become poor, whoever loves wine and oil will never be rich, it's not giving us a universally applicable rule. But did you hear or read last week or last fortnight that report that came out about the abuse of alcohol not simply being a problem for the young and the deprived? They got the stats out on it, and it's much more universal than that. And maybe that general rule about self-indulgence does need to be taken in the South Cambridgeshire Chardonnay belt. Alcohol is perfectly capable of wrecking lives and fortunes amongst up and outs, just as it does amongst down and outs. So that's one counsel on how not to lose money. Another repeated counsel in Proverbs, how not to lose money, I think also needs to be heard today. Proverbs 22, verse 7, the borrower is servant to the lender. Remember that the next time you get a loan offer or a credit card application in the post. I guess lots of people, when that happens, there's a thought process that runs through their minds that goes something like this. At last, I can get some clothes, I can get some new furniture, and there can be an end to this constant not having things I want thing that marks my life. But they don't stop to think, how will I manage the monthly repayments? They don't do the maths. And that's a mistaken assumption that drives that sort of train of thought, that the banks are trying to do them a kindness, when of course banks are being banks. They're trying to make money. And people end up in bondage. The borrower is servant to the lender. That's a slavery which Wilberforce wasn't able to abolish, sadly. And I guess it would be a huge liberation for many, many people, maybe some of us here, if we were to work systematically to pay off our debts and then actually to dispose of the credit card, cut it up. That's not a command. It's not a sin to take out a student loan or a mortgage. That's just a general observation which acts as a warning. So how to make money and how not to lose money. And I thought by way of introduction this morning, it would be useful to give you some of the practical wisdom of the book. There's lots of that sort of wisdom here. But I chose to focus us on chapter 3 for a very good reason. Maybe you're familiar with how the whole book of Proverbs is structured. The first 9 chapters of the book introduce the other 22. And most of the sort of practical suggestions come in the last section from chapter 10 onwards. But chapters 1 to 9 introduce the later chapters. And they make one major point. Pursue wisdom by putting God first in your life. So my first main heading on the sheets is that, the priority of a God-centered life. And really any verse I care to choose from the bit that Tim Jenkins read to us in chapter 3 would make that point. It's there in those very well-known verses, verses 5 and 6. Trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge him and he'll make your paths straight. Just saying, if I'll only trust God and not rely on my own unsound judgment, if I'll actually let God be God and follow his leading and do what his word says, then he will direct my paths. I won't go wrong in life. His ways have got to have priority over my own ways. And that bears testimony to the priority of a God-centered life. But because our topic is how to prosper, I wanted to focus on some verses from later in the chapter under this heading. They're verses which talk about material wealth, Look at verse 13 and the next bit. Blessed is the man who finds wisdom, the man who gains understanding. For she's more profitable than silver and yields better returns than gold. She's more precious than rubies. Nothing you desire can compare with her. So, like I said at the start, it's interesting how the Bible recognizes that we're all driven by the profit motive. Here is why the God-centered life makes sense. Because it pays. Actually, more than a lottery win ever could. Those who arrange their lives around God's priorities and the goal of gaining wisdom, going God's way, will find it's better than any material blessing they could ever dream of. You think you want silver? Says the writer. Proverbs says, wisdom is better. You think you want gold? Wisdom is better. Or change the equation. Fame, fortune, power, achievement. Wisdom is better. Nothing, he says, you desire can compare with her. And I think that explains the odd one out section in the chapter. See if you can see which you think are the rogue verses that Tim Jenkins read to us. Just have a scan your eyes down the column and a half that he read. I think it's verses 11 and 12. My son, do not despise the Lord's discipline, and do not resent his rebuke, because the Lord disciplines those he loves, as a father the son he delights in. All the other verses are really positive, and they're full of health and wealth. And it's a little duet there, those two verses are slightly different. Here, the writer acknowledges that we will all need discipline as God's children. He doesn't have spoilt brat children. So every once in a while, from time to time, every child of God is going to be put through what we could call the school of hard knocks. God will put us through some tough circumstances which we wouldn't choose in our life, whatever they might be, ill health, trouble at work, financial hardship, family issues. That's not because he hates us. This says it's actually because he loves us. Because it's more important for us to be holy than happy all the time. And he teaches us in these ways something that maybe we wouldn't learn if the sun shone on us all the time. Because the God-centered life is a priority, wisdom. Living his way is actually best. I wonder if you're willing to reset your value system. What we value so highly isn't always as important as we think. Certainly the prosperity that money allows us on its own, that type of prosperity, falls actually far short of real prosperity. Money can buy you a bed, someone said, but it cannot buy you sleep. It can buy you books, but it can't buy learning. It can buy food, but it can't buy an appetite. It can buy medicine, but it can't buy health. It can buy cosmetics, but it can't buy beauty. It can buy amusement, but it can't buy happiness. I suppose in the end you could say it could buy the earth, but it cannot buy heaven. There's a really important verse later on in the book which acknowledges the priority of a God-centered life. You've got it on the sheet. Wealth is worthless in the day of wrath. But Proverbs 11 verse 4 says, but righteousness delivers from death. There was some discussion I found rooting around in the learned tomes on that verse as to whether that's just talking about a sort of principle of life in this world. So when a day of calamity comes, money is no use. And if you think about it in economic terms, that makes sense, doesn't it? What happens when disaster comes to a country? Inflation puts the prices through the roof. That was what happened in post-war Germany. People paying with, you know, fistfuls of money just for a few slices of bread. I've seen the same thing in Zimbabwe, of course, recently. Wealth is worthless in the day of wrath. But, he says, remember the priority of a God-centered life. Righteousness delivers from death. Sure, I've told some of you, if you were at All Saints in the past, that misprint in one of the hymns on the order of service at the funeral of a very rich person once. It was supposed to say, land me safe on Canaan's side in the hymns. And instead it said, land my safe on Canaan's side. That was what he was hoping for. You see, even if we could take our money with us, it would do us no good. No matter how much money we have on the day of our death, when we come face to face with God, there's actually only one currency which will count there, righteousness. And the person who trusts God can know for sure that they will be delivered. They may not be rich, but they are righteous because Jesus has given them that most precious gift, his righteousness, earned when he died for them on the cross. So they can be forgiven. Now that's why, ultimately, the Bible stresses the priority of a God-centered life. It's the only way to lasting, real prosperity in the presence of God. Now, more briefly, and this may be interesting to you, just having seen those graphs up on the screen, the generosity of a God-centered life. Let me read the verses we started with again, verses 9 and 10. Honor the Lord with your wealth, with the first fruits of all your crops. Then your barns will be filled to overflowing, your vats will brim over with new wine. The background to those two verses actually is the Old Testament harvest festival, which was known as the first fruits. Where what you did, when the crops were due to be harvested, I gave the best and the first of my crops to God as an act of worship to him, to honor him, as it says here. You'll remember there were 12 tribes in Israel. The Levites were one of them. They had the responsibility for the temple and its day-to-day running. And they didn't have, well, they had hardly any tribal land, just a fringe around the towns where they lived. But they didn't have any tribal land like the other 11 tribes for farming. And their work at the temple took up a lot of the time. So the other 11 tribes were supposed to keep the priests and the Levites supplied with food by bringing their first fruits offerings to the temple. And I suppose you could put it like this, here's the point. If they didn't honor the Levites by doing that, because the Levites got those first fruits, they didn't honor God. It was as simple as that. You were saying, the temple doesn't really matter to me. The running costs of God's temple were supposed to be met by the giving of God's people. Now, the standard is exactly the same in the Christian church. We are not, I personally think, urged to give 10% as they were. But we are encouraged to give proportionately, according to our means, is how it gets put in 2 Corinthians chapter 8. And for some, that might mean giving more than 10%, and not as a burden, but joyfully, for God loves a cheerful giver, says Paul. Actually, that principle of proportionate giving is also an encouragement to those who have less wealth at any one point in time. I was thinking of the teenagers in our evening service at All Saints. I know that not many teenagers are exactly flush with money, but they can begin at that stage to give proportionately according to your means. You might reflect how you might begin to teach these principles to some of the children even in the church. Jesus said that whoever can be trusted with very little can also be trusted with much. So they shouldn't do nothing just because the amounts are small. I think Jesus says that if we get into the habit of giving now, with the small amount we have available, then the implication is we'll have more to give later on. One day they will have the opportunity to show their faithfulness in bigger ways. One way or another, the costs of supporting the kingdom of God are meant to fall on ordinary Christians giving together. And I've been thinking about this a lot because we discuss all these things in the deanery. You're mercifully delivered from having to think about how the other churches in the area raise their money. But I wish this was better understood by the Christian church. Because there are lots of ways churches can go about trying to raise money. I thought of some options for All Saints. We could go into the property business and fund the church on rent. We could do it by gambling and run tombolas and lotteries at all our events. We could go into entertainment, sell tickets for barn dances at a profit, and hire out the North Building for private functions, our lovely building on our site there. We could boost our income by spend all my time doing baptisms, marriages, and funerals at a fee. We could charge, I think, much more than £1 a week for our TOTS group. And we can get, if we had athletic people like Tim. We could get them to run half marathons and collect sponsorship money from them and things like that. All sorts of ways you could do it. And they're always actually that churches try to balance the books, but they are not the way that God has promised to bless. That's the significant thing. God blesses the voluntary, proportional giving of his people. And you will find, if you know the sort of stats and look around, not surprisingly, churches which try to raise money in those other ways almost inevitably condemn themselves to financial difficulty because they are not under God's blessing as ways of raising money. Whereas here, if we give generously, God will pour down huge blessing on us. And I hope you take that encouragement. It's fantastic to hear how you're doing. See in verses 9 and 10 how our generosity is more than matched by God's generosity. Honor the Lord with your wealth, with the first fruits of all your crops. Then your barns will be filled to overflowing, and your vats will brim over with new wine. Those promises surely point beyond this world, ultimately, as we've thought already, to the prosperity that's going to be in heaven. Amos says that the mountains will flow with new wine there. But as we think this morning about the generosity of a God-centered life, let's not forget the amazing generosity of God to us, if we're his followers. You and I are never, never going to outgive God. We're never going to do that. But nicely, Proverbs does invite us at least to try.